From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with David Mamet, one of America's most important contemporary writers. His plays include Glengarry Glen Ross, Speed the Plow, and Oleanna. He wrote and directed the films Homicide and House of Games. Now he's just written his first novel. Also, we talk with NPR's senior news analyst, Daniel Schorr, about his career in journalism. One of the turning points in that career was discovering, while he was live on camera, that he was included on President Nixon's enemies list. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel and Jordan have initialed a draft agreement. That's the last step before a formal peace treaty is signed. A ceremony is planned for the end of the month to mark the accord, and President Clinton has been invited. Barry Schwide reports.
The Israel-Jordan agreement makes it possible for President Clinton to make a triumphant trip to the Middle East before the election. The agreement has support in all sectors of the Israeli public, and consequently, participating in a signing ceremony can help the president as midterm elections in the U.S. approach. On other fronts, though, U.S. peacemaking is moving very slowly. Violence has marred Israel's talks with the PLO, though with some nudging from Washington, they are resuming. And despite five trips to the Middle East by Secretary of State Warren Christopher since May, Israel and Syria are still far apart on a peace treaty. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide is calling again for peace and reconciliation. Hours before his speech at the National Palace, a mob burned the home of the new Haitian Army commander's mother. The house was torched after a false rumor spread that Major General Jean-Claude Dupaval had tried to kill President Aristide. A Russian journalist was killed today when a bomb went off in the offices of Moscow's most popular newspaper. The reporter had recently written articles about corruption in the Russian army. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Moscow.
According to the editor of Moskovsky Komsomolets, reporter Dmitry Holodov had recently received threatening letters and phone calls because of his articles. He reportedly had just picked up a package or briefcase from a locker at the Kazan railway station. After an unknown person phoned advising him where to find interesting materials related to military corruption. When he opened the container, employees say it blew up, shattering the paper's newsroom, killing Holodov and wounding another reporter. Moskovsky Komsomolets is an irreverent paper which regularly takes on high officials. Holodov had written several stories exposing corruption in the army and was slated to appear before the parliament to discuss bribe-taking and illegal weapon sales by the Russian army in Germany. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
The United Nations says the Angolan government and the Angolan rebels have agreed on a peace treaty to end their 20-year-old civil war. The pact is supposed to stop the fighting that has persisted despite previous peace treaties, a national election, and international pressure. The negotiators are to return to their camps, and a signing ceremony is expected within days. Some 350,000 Angolans died after civil war broke out in 1975. A peace accord signed in 91 brought a brief peace and elections in 92. But more fighting broke out. Another 150,000 more lives were lost. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 12 points at 3922. This is NPR. A new poll by the Associated Press finds that 54% of the 1,005 people questioned think it is time they had someone new representing them in Congress. 35% say their current representative should be returned to office. But only 2 in 5 people who want a different lawmaker say they're happy with the candidates they have to choose from. The poll questioned people randomly within the 48 contiguous states between October 7th and 11th. There is a margin of error of 3 percentage points, plus or minus. 11,000 United Auto Workers have rejected a contract offer by tractor maker Deere and Company. Union workers defeated the plan by a margin of more than 90%. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
Union members defeated a plan that would have established a two-tier wage plan and cut benefits and pay by about 30% for new employees. The two-year pact also proposed a 2% raise for those workers in the second and third years. but union officials say it included no increase in base pay. That's been the real sticking point between the two sides in this labor dispute. And that's the reason union leaders urged workers to reject the idea, which they did by a margin of more than 90%. Even though the deal failed, both sides say they want to continue negotiations, and there is no talk of a strike, at least not yet. The 11,000 Deere and Company employees are working under an extended contract that expired last month. Workers covered by the UAW contract are paid an average of $22 an hour, including benefits. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran reporting.
Denver teachers have returned to work today after a week-long strike. Students return to class tomorrow. The marathon three-day negotiating session ended on Saturday when the teachers overwhelmingly approved an agreement. Colorado Governor Roy Romer mediated the deal. Teachers will receive more pay and they will also have more planning time. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I love listening to dialogue written by David Mamet. It has the same effect on me as good music. I want to replay it over and over again. Mamet is one of America's most important playwrights and screenwriters. His plays include the Pulitzer Prize-winning Glengarry Glen Ross, Speed the Plow, American Buffalo, and Sexual Perversity in Chicago. He wrote and directed the films House of Games, Things Change, and Homicide, and wrote the screenplays for The Untouchables, The Verdict, and Hoffa. His film version of his play Oleana opens next month. Also about to open is a film of his adaptation of Chekhov's Uncle Vanya. Now David Mamet has written his first novel. It's called The Village, and it's set in Vermont, where he lives part of each year. I asked Mamet if the dialogue he writes for actors is different from the dialogue on the page in his new novel.
I think that what I'm concerned about is rhythm, and on a stage, the actors communicate with each other, and the play is communicated to the audience through the rhythm of their speech. But on a page, I find it fascinating that the rhythm is very, very different. If you transpose the actual dialogue onto the page, the nature of the medium is such that the rhythm is going to be changed by the interpolation of descriptions. He said, she said, and then he picked up the coffee cup, and so that the most important rhythm, it seems to me, on the page is the rhythm of the written line, which contains both the dialogue and description, rather than the rhythm of the dialogue itself, which on the stage is all that you have.
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned rhythm, because I happen to have a scene picked out from your film Homicide, which you wrote and directed, which I think it really just shows the kind of rhythm that you get between two characters that you write for. And this is a scene from fairly early on in Homicide. The story is about two cops, partners, played by Joe Mantegna and Bill Macy. And Mantegna is a cop who's been unjustly reprimanded by his new boss after the FBI has bungled a case. And his new boss has called Mantegna a kike. Macy has just stood up for him. And here's Mantegna and Macy in the cop car together talking.
Man's got no call to question my loyalty.
How's your head?
He had no call to get Rachel on.
So he called you one, you called him one. We get to the gym.
Son of a bitch is gonna go.
Yeah, I feel it too.
Piece of cake.
Either a piece of cake or a slice of life. You notice that?
Yeah, I've remarked that. Ain't that the truth?
That is the truth.
We could have brought the son of a bitch in with a knock on the door.
Well, let's go bring him in then.
That's right.
Garner some of them kudos and all that they got.
That's right. FBI, man.
That's right.
FBI could f*** up a baked potato.
FBI couldn't find Joe Lewis in a bowl of rice. You know what's needed here?
What, Sully?
Police work.
Yeah. Some of that police work that people talk about. What happened to the job? Politics, man. Nothing but politics. Mother called me a kike.
I heard him.
Job's changed. It ain't the same job.
The job's the same.
Yeah.
People dying. People killing them.
I think of you writing lines in a very musical way and then being performed, when performed well, in a musical way. And when I read your screenplays, I can see that, you know, you italicize certain words for emphasis. Some words you put in parentheses so that they'll be read in a different way. If you want to pause, you'll write beat after the phrase is over. Do you think of yourself as scoring the dialogue?
I suppose it's one way one could look at it. I just think of it as writing it. And, you know, you were describing the various things that I do and writing dialogue, and I thought, oh, what a terrible way for a writer to behave. And then I comforted myself by saying, well, at least I don't write stage directions.
Well, do the actors, are the actors bothered by the fact that you're telling them where the emphasis should fall and where the beat should fall?
I don't think so. I think that, well, first off, I tend to work with the same actors all the time. I mean,
like Mantegna and Maisie, who we just heard.
That's right. I mean, we go back about a quarter of a century together, the three of us. One of the nice things about working with the same people over and over again is that it's great to be trusted. It's great to be able to give an actor a script and know that he or she will trust that the line's going to work and read the line as it's written.
Were the people in your family good talkers?
Oh, no, they were great talkers. Good wasn't even in it. They were, and the surviving members continue to be the best talkers that ever lived.
What made them great?
Well, many things. Our Ashkenazi Jewish heritage, the fact that my parents both grew up in the Depression and in poverty, perhaps a disrupted family life, and a 6,000-year-old Jewish tradition of love of argument.
You started off as an actor, right?
Yeah, that's right. I was actually a child actor in Chicago. When I was just a kid, but I guess that's when one would be a child actor. And then I got interested in community theater. Mm-hmm. And then I went, was very interested in acting in college. And as I say, I studied for a while in New York, and I tried to support myself as an actor and did marginally for a while, and realized that I was either going to need a personality transplant or I was going to starve. And loath to leave the theater, I did what countless millions have done before me. I found something else I could do inside of that society, and that happened to be directing.
Why did you mention a personality transplant?
I didn't have the personality to be an actor. I mean, I think it's a great gift. I think acting is a skill which many people can learn a little bit of, and which a few people can learn a lot of, and which several people are born with a great talent for. And I think I didn't belong to any of those groups.
So you didn't think you were very good at it?
No, I knew I wasn't any good at it.
Did you have the ego for it?
The ego? No, I think I had too much ego. I think that was the problem.
Uh-huh.
I think that...
How does that get in the way? Too much ego?
You know, Sandy Meisner was my teacher at the Playhouse. I seem to be talking about that a lot. I think it's because I'm in the studio, which happens to be about four blocks from where the school was. And I seldom come back to this neighborhood. He used to say it took about 20 years to make an actor. And I often wondered what he meant. But now I've had the experience of working with actors, with the same actors for 20, some of them for 20 years and more, and have seen the great sacrifices, the great dedication, and the, to use a perhaps overblown word, the cleansing process that one has to go through to become a great actor, to have the ego pared away and the preconceptions pared away, and to have one's courage and character built up by years of striving. It's a magnificent process. It's been a great privilege to watch it, and the actors that I've worked with for those years.
Was your ego so big that you would be rewriting the lines that you were given?
Exactly so. I mean, perhaps I'm being too harsh on myself. Perhaps it wasn't a question of ego. Perhaps it was just a question of disposition. But that was my disposition, to want to rewrite the lines, to want to correct the director, etc.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Mamet, and he has a new novel, his first novel, called The Village. You've written that most acting training is based on shame and guilt. How did you experience that?
Well, I went to a lot of acting classes and worked with a lot of directors, and I didn't see many of them that were capable of stating a direction or an instruction that was capable of being fulfilled. One heard a lot in the back in the 60s and 70s, and perhaps one still does today, things like feel it more, be more yourself, relax, feel the space, use the space, listen to it with your body, reach out to the other person, talk like you mean it. These are words which don't mean anything and which mask on the part of the speaker either an ignorance of their subject matter or the desire to defraud. And they confuse the hell out of me as an actor.
So I imagine these are directions you try to never give actors who are working with you.
That's right.
What might you tell them instead?
Well, what I try to do as a director is understand what the scene's about and communicate it to the actor in specific ways. Somebody wrote, if the direction is more generalized or less actable and go over there and open the window, it's no good. And so that is the kind of direction to which I aspire. And it calls for a lot of thought sometime on the part of the director, because there are many times under pressure, and directors, as the actor is under pressure quite a lot, there's a tendency to think, oh my God, just do it better. But that sure don't help the actor. And B, the actor's trying to do it better. That's all the actor wants to do, is do it better, for God's sake.
From reading your essays, I get the impression that you don't like it when somebody tries to put a lot of emotion into a scene, you know, and to put a lot of their personal expression into a scene. You write, the more an actor tries to make each physical action carry the meaning of the scene, the more the actor is ruining your movie.
Well, they're also ruining their performance, sure.
By putting in too much.
Sure. I mean, all of us have had the experience, and we have it more the older we get, of being in extraordinarily dramatic life situations, birth, death, loss, betrayal, enlightenment, danger, humiliation. And I think I've reflected, and I think that others perhaps have a similar experience, that in these situations, we and those around us tend to act in a rather undramatic manner, because our task and our difficulty are so vast that we have no energy left over to describe them to ourselves or to communicate them to others. We have only energy left over to do them as simply as possible, because our life depends on it. And that, to me, is what great acting is. It's doing the most extraordinary things in the simplest possible manner.
You grew up in a middle-class family in Chicago, but you write that you used to think that the middle class was unfit for literature. Why did you think that, and what, if anything, changed you?
Well, I wanted to get out of the house. I was a nice Jewish boy. I think I probably am a nice Jewish boy, and that... And I wanted to be anything but a nice Jewish boy. I wanted to be Jack Kerouac, you know, or Jack London, or someone named Jack. And the one thing I didn't want to do was to write about that day-to-day bourgeois existence. Now, I turn around 30 years later, and I see much of the stuff that I wrote under the guise of the picaresque was nothing other than a domestic play. You know, whether it's American Buffalo is finally a play about a family constellation.
Well, did not wanting to write about your own middle-class life have anything to do with writing about con men and cops? And
sure, I mean, that was another part of the escape. Yeah, I wanted to get out of the birth family, and perhaps like a lot of people who go into a hermetic world, I wanted to escape into another family.
Well, how did you, I mean, it seems to me you ended up hanging out at pool halls and having your poker games and, you know, meeting people from a different world. How did you meet them?
I got out of the house, and I was I had to make a living. I was out there working at many different kinds of jobs, and meeting very interesting people. And I loved it.
What kinds of jobs?
Oh, I worked in a truck factory. I drove a cab. Worked for a while one summer on the ore boats. Worked in a canning factory. I sold land over the telephone. I cleaned offices. Worked in a book. I did a bookshop. I did a lot of food work, busing and short order cooking, and waited on tables.
You have one of your early plays is called A Life in the Theater. And you've written that you were taught and that you believe that the purpose of the play is to bring to the stage the life of the human soul. Now, the actors in your play, A Life in the Theater, say they believe that, too. But all the plays they act in are like the worst cliches, the lifeboat scene,
right.
The battle scene when a young soldier's tour of duty is up in 2 hours, but he's about to be shot down in battle.
Right.
I wonder, in your life in the theater when you were an actor, if you were up against that, too, having all these, like, deeply felt aesthetic ideas of what life in the theater is, but you found yourself acting things that you, in fact, thought were quite cliched.
Oh, sure. Sure. That quote, by the way, is from Stanislavski. I do believe that that's the task of the theater, is to bring to the stage the life of the human soul. But that's a quote from Konstantin Stanislavski.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure. You know, I was once at Sardi's restaurant here, and they just refurbished it, and I looked out, and I was given a speech for something or other, I can't remember what it was, and I looked out, and I said, so nice to be back here at Sardi's and look out at all these beautiful tables, and I know that there has never been a conversation at any of these tables which did not contain the phrase, and do you know what that son of a bitch did? So you talk about having difficulty dealing with cliches in the theater at one point. Well, all of us in the theater on day one and on day 20 and 30 years later and 50 years later and 80 years later still get together every night, one could say, A, with a sense of wonder at the world around us, or one could say equally B, bitching at the very interesting and the very exacting life we've chosen.
David Mamet, I wish we had more time. It's been a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Pleasure talking to you, finally.
David Mamet's new novel is called The Village. His film adaptation of his play Oleana opens next month. This is Fresh Air. Did you know that one of the first productions of a David Mamet play was on National Public Radio? This week, public radio stations all around the country are fundraising. We're singing our own praises not because it's in our nature to brag, but because we must remind you about our urgent need for your support. One of our ambitions on Fresh Air is to connect you with some of the best writers, composers, and performers of our time, people like David Mamet. Right now, your station is depending on Fresh Air fans to call with a pledge so that the station can afford to broadcast Fresh Air in the months to come. Here's how to make that pledge. Thanks. This is Fresh Air. Most people think rhythm and blues is an invention of the post-war era, something that originated with musicians like Ray Charles and Roy Brown and the early doo-wop groups. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of one of the true pioneers of R&B.
It's an all-too-familiar irony. Here's one of America's most influential musicians, but none of his records are in print in this country. And when I mentioned his name to an otherwise well-informed person the other day, the reaction I got was, "Who?" Yet Louis Jordan, a short, alto saxophone-playing black man with a goofy smile and a natural gift for comedy, can, I think, be said to have invented rhythm and blues, to have been one of the first black artists to sell as well with whites as with blacks, and to have been directly responsible for inspiring rock and roll by giving Chuck Berry something to aim at. Louis Jordan was born on July 8, 1908, in Brinkley, Arkansas, and first shows up in the reference books as a member of Chick Webb's popular band in the mid-30s. He made his first recordings in 1939, and the next year he recorded the first one in his inimitable style.
You cats keep beating up your chops. I ought to turn you over to the cops. But dig this field, I'm gonna lay on your gate. Don't cop your broom, park the body and wait. You run your mouth and I run my business, brother. You run your mouth and I run my business, brother. You tell everybody I'm busted. You talk so much you got me disgusted. But you run your mouth and I run my business, brother.
All that hip jive talk went over well with jazz fans, and his band, called the Timpani Five, although there were usually seven or eight of them, none of whom played timpani, laid down a rhythm everybody could dance to. Jordan's records quickly sold well enough that he was one of the few artists who recorded commercially during the Second World War and one of the few black artists who had a major label deal with Decca. But after the war, Louis Jordan's career really took off.
Heading for the station with a pack on my back. I'm tired of transportation in the back of a hack. I love to hear the rhythm of the clickety-clack and hear the lonesome whistle, see the smoke from the stack and pal around with Democratic fellas named Mac. So take me right back to the track, Jack. Choo-choo, choo-choo, jaboogie. Woo-woo, woo-woo, jaboogie. Choo-choo, choo-choo, jaboogie. Take me right back to the track, Jack.
Choo Choo Jaboogie was Jordan's second million-selling record, and it decimated the charts in 1946. His most famous record, though, had come out a year earlier and hadn't sold as well because dozens of other artists recorded it at about the same time in imitation of the Jordan magic.
Walking with my baby, she got great big feet. She long, lean, and lank, and ain't had nothing to eat. But she's my baby, and I love her just the same. Crazy about that woman, cause Caledonia is her name. Caledonia! Caledonia! I want to make your big head so hot, Ma. I love you just the same. I'll always love you, baby, cause Caledonia is your name.
Caledonia, as an expression of dismay or exasperation, entered the language in black communities right away. And 20 years later, I heard a black teenager put down another's antiquated taste by calling it Caledonia-fied. Jordan was hot. He made a record with Bing Crosby. He made another one with Ella Fitzgerald. And hot on the heels of Caledonia, he made another record whose title wound up on everybody's lips.
One night, Farmer Brown was taking the air, locked up the barnyard with the greatest of care. Down in the hen house, something stirred when he shouted, "Who's there?" This is what he heard. "There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. So calm yourself and stop that fuss. There ain't nobody here but us. We chickens trying to sleep and you butt in and hobble, 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 hobble with your chin."
Now, with a record like this, Jordan was skating on thin ice. On the one hand, Farmer Brown being told to mind his own business by a voice from the hen house is a pretty funny story. On the other, this is yet another stereotype tale of black people stealing chickens because, the stereotype says, they're too lazy to work. The good humor, I think, overwhelms the dark side of the song. After all, there's no evidence of the chicken thief's race. But in the years ahead, as black self-image became an issue, Jordan's stock would fall. And there's no doubt that his stories, as epitomized in this 1949 smash hit, were of an earlier era.
Now, if you ever been down to New Orleans, then you can understand just what I mean. Now, all through the week it's quiet as a mouse, but on Saturday night they go from house to house. You don't have to pay the usual admission if you're a cook or a waiter or a good musician. So if you happen to be just passing by, stop in at the Saturday night fish fry. It was rocking. It was rocking. You never seen such scuffling and shuffling till the break of dawn.
But during this time, probably because Jordan was, like Louis Armstrong, a safe sort of black entertainer, he was the highest-grossing black act in the country and one of the highest-grossing of all. His small combo pointed the way to the modern rhythm and blues band, and his unusual humorous slice-of-life songs delivered in rapid-fire patter got Chuck Berry thinking about writing some himself. Louis Jordan died in 1975 of a heart attack, just as a new generation was rediscovering his genius and realizing that this funny little man might just have been the grandfather of rhythm and blues.
Ed Ward is the co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He's now living in Germany. We're featuring a series of his rock and roll profiles throughout the week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a conversation with NPR's senior news analyst Daniel Schorr about his long career in journalism. When he was chief correspondent for CBS News, he became part of the story. His name showed up on Nixon's enemies list. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says he's delighted at the news of a draft peace accord initialed between Israel and Jordan. UPI's Carol Van Dam has this report.
On his way to Albuquerque, New Mexico, for a speech to police chiefs, President Clinton congratulated Jordan's King Hussein and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin for initialing the peace agreement. The president says the people of Jordan and Israel are embarking on a journey of peace that will bring a bright future for generations to come.
At a time when hatred and extremism and threatening behavior still stalk the Middle East, this agreement reminds us that moderation and reason are prevailing.
The U.S. has served as mediator in the talks. Mr. Clinton says the U.S. will continue to stand by Jordan and Israel every step of the way. Carol Van Dam, the White House.
The White House chief of staff says U.S. troops in the Persian Gulf aren't leaving yet. Leanne Panetta told NBC today a United Nations resolution approved over the weekend makes it clear Saddam Hussein must pull back Iraqi troops from southern Iraq. Panetta says until this happens, U.S. troops are staying put and alert. The administration says there are some signs of an Iraqi retreat, but officials are waiting to be sure. Government safety experts say millions of General Motors pickup trucks made between 1973 and 1987 pose an unreasonable safety risk. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The GM pickups in question have gas tanks mounted outside the truck's main frame. An investigation by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has now concluded that the tanks are a hazard during collisions and have caused some 150 avoidable deaths and numerous injuries. Secretary of Transportation Federico Peña said investigators have evidence that General Motors knew the trucks posed a safety hazard but continued to build them.
Despite mounting evidence of a safety risk over the intervening years, GM did not move the tanks inside the frame rails until model year 1988.
Peña said the Transportation Department will begin formal hearings in December on whether to recall the trucks, known as the CK series. Department spokesmen say there are about 4.5 million of these trucks still on the road. I'm Christopher Joyce reporting.
Authorities in Montgomery County, Texas, say that two people have drowned in flash flooding in southeast Texas. Two more people are missing. The county sheriff for Montgomery County says a body was found today downstream from a car that had tried to cross a flooded road. The other victim, an elderly man, was discovered outside his truck. The missing people were apparently swept away by floodwaters last night after they drove their car into rising creek waters. The National Weather Service has unconfirmed reports of several tornadoes in the region. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow rose 13.5 points to close at 3,923. Declining issues led advances. This is NPR. The Indiana State Prison is under lockdown. Five death row inmates had tried to escape. Corrections officials say that four inmates used homemade weapons to cut around window bars. They got as far as the prison recreation yard before they were caught. A fifth inmate who had a knife was trying to escape his cell when guards stopped him with tear gas. One guard was slightly injured in the struggle. Japan's trade surplus fell slightly in the first 6 months of the year. It's the first time this has happened in 3.5 years. But the Japanese trade surplus with the United States continued to increase. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
Economists have said that the long-term trend is a declining surplus for Japan, and today its merchandise trade surplus fell 4.6% in September from a year ago. For the six-month period April through September, Japan registered a slight decline of almost 1%, representing the first decrease for the same period since 1990. Economists largely attribute the drop to a long-running weakening of the dollar against the yen, which makes imports more attractive because it makes them cheaper. But the stubborn surplus with the United States grew last month by almost 2.5%. Forecasters, however, predict that surplus, too, will begin to slightly drop as big-ticket items such as U.S. cars continue to sell more briskly in Japan. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Defense Secretary William Perry and Chinese officials are agreeing on some issues they're discussing, but not all. Perry is in Beijing for talks. Chinese officials say they'll support U.S. efforts to resolve the nuclear arms dispute with North Korea. A senior U.S. official says China wants the Korean Peninsula non-nuclear, but there is no agreement between the officials on human rights. The U.S. official says Beijing and Washington have major differences on human rights and how they're defined. The issue is considered very sensitive. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Occasionally, we like to feature interviews with some of the journalists whose work you know from National Public Radio. Daniel Shore is NPR's senior news analyst. Shore worked for CBS from 1953 to 1976. He was brought there by Edward R. Murrow. He covered Watergate for CBS, and that landed him on Nixon's enemies list. He left the network after a falling out with CBS over the publication of a suppressed House Intelligence Committee report, which had been leaked to Shore. From 1979 to 85, Shore was CNN's senior Washington correspondent. I asked Dan Shore about one of the most dramatic moments of his career, which occurred during CBS's live coverage of the Watergate hearings.
Here was John Dean testifying in June 1973 before Senator Ervin's Watergate Committee. And in his testimony, he said that at the White House they had drawn up something called enemies lists, but he didn't read them, so that we waited until the end of the session to get the first copies of what had been submitted in evidence. And there we were outside the Senate caucus room waiting for the hearing to break so that we could get on the air. I say we, Sam Donaldson of ABC and Douglas Kiker of NBC and myself, standing more or less shoulder to shoulder and talking into our own cameras, each wanting to be 2 or 3 seconds ahead of the other in revealing whom the Nixon people considered to be enemies. And so the thing was handed to me live on television. And I said, here it is, the first of the enemies list from John Dean. It's headed on screwing up political enemies. And let me begin to read it to you. I see there 20 numbered names. And went down the list and came indeed, as you suggested, to number 17, where it said, Daniel Shore, a real media enemy. And I kind of gulped and went right down to the next name and down to the last name, which was Mary McGrory, and said, now back to you, trying as hard as I could to pretend that my name belonged to somebody else because I had suddenly been dragged into the story I was covering. And that is, for me, a real no-no. I mean, I want to stand outside, and they had pulled me inside.
Okay, so you tried to not reveal what you were feeling on the air, but what is it that you were feeling when you came up to number 17?
Well, what I was feeling, I mean, it didn't really bother me that I was on the enemies list, although it didn't occur to me that I was important enough in their terms to get on the enemies list. So astonished was the word for it, but much more because I had such a long life in journalism, from print to radio to television and all, that my standards were being violated. I'm supposed to be the observer, the fly on the wall, and suddenly I had to say my own name as part of the story that I was covering, and somehow the electrifying effect of having to deal with that professional problem overcame everything else.
Some people who made it onto that enemies list considered it a badge of honor. Did you?
Oh, yes. Well, a badge of honor. It turned out to be very useful. First of all, by the time I was aware of the enemies list, I knew nothing ever was going to happen about it, although I had been audited rather curiously by the IRS. But yes, it was there were buttons handed out by some well-meaning people that read Dean's List. And after a while, I found it was increasing my invitations to dinner parties that I like to go to, and adding to my lecture fee. So, you know, as I recall, you know...
Boy, did they do you a favor.
Yeah, did they do me. And some of my colleagues who were not on the enemies list came to be a little resentful. Dan Rather, who had been covering the White House then, somehow didn't make it on the enemies list, and he didn't like that at all.
Now, President Nixon also ordered an FBI investigation of you on the pretext that you were in line for a top federal job. So, of course, they had to investigate you. How did you find out about this investigation?
Well, very simply. What happened, he had Haldeman have his assistant, Larry Higby, call J. Edgar Hoover and simply say, the boss, the president, wants to have some background stuff on correspondent named Daniel Ashore. And apparently Hoover misunderstood, either really misunderstood or maybe mischievously chose to misunderstand. The word background is used by the FBI, is commonly used for background checks on people who are going to be nominated to presidential positions, presidential appointments. And so there apparently was some misunderstanding, with the result that the investigation that was ordered by Hoover was basically a wide-open investigation in which agents called up my employer, called up members of my family, and indeed sent an FBI agent up to CBS to interview me. And when I said, what is this all about, he said, presumably you know, these are usually done for pre-appointment investigations. I said, but nobody's offered me anything. When the word got back that this had happened, they quickly and rather precipitously called off the investigation and then began to have a damage control meeting as to what to do when the story came out. And so all those wonderful people, Ron Ziegler and Chuck Colson, all got together and said, well, the only thing we can do is to say that he was under consideration for a job, however preposterous that may seem, and actually identify a job.
What job did they come up with for
it? It was a public relations person for the Council on Environmental Quality, which was then headed by Russell Train, who a long time later apologized to me profusely because he knew that he had been used for that purpose. You want me to tell you how that story ended many years later?
Sure.
Well, the interesting thing was that in the months before his death, Nixon and I had a reconciliation of sorts. I found myself being invited to small dinners where Nixon was giving briefings on his trips to the former Soviet Union. And at one of these, the first of these dinners, I was wondering if he remembered who I was or why I was being invited, and unable to resist that temptation. At the end of dinner, I went up to Nixon and I said, Mr. Nixon, I'm not sure you will remember me, but... And he interrupted me, and he said, oh, sure, Dan, sure. Damn near hired you once.
Did he believe that?
No, he didn't believe that. That was his little joking way of trying to make up. I don't know. It was a quip. He said it with a smile, and I'm sure he had worked it out in his mind that he was going to say it to me. But the fact of the matter was he wanted... To be forgiven or forgotten or whatever, and I found it not difficult to do that.
Daniel Ashore, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your early years, your coming of age, and your start in journalism. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the neighborhood you grew up in.
Well, I grew up in the Bronx in a semi-poor but respectable neighborhood. From a very early age, as far as I can even remember, journalism was all I wanted to do. And I remember the first money I earned from journalism when I was about 13 years old. We lived on the ground floor of a tenement. And one day I heard a big plop outside the window and looked out the window, and lying there was somebody who had fallen or jumped off the roof. And so cool as a reporter ought to be, I waited for police to arrive, found out what I could, and called a local newspaper, which paid $5 for news tips, and dictated a story. And that was really, in a sense, a benchmark for what was to be my career, in that if you can see something which might make you, which might affect you, and find yourself not affected except wanting to know what it's all about so you can explain it to other people, I think that's the basis of a journalistic career. It is removing yourself from drama so you can describe the drama.
Were your parents immigrants, or were they born? So, did they speak English well?
No. Well, I really don't remember how well my father spoke English, because I was about 5 when he died, and I have very little memory of that. My mother spoke with an accent for all of her life, although she pretty well educated herself and read a great deal and was very literate. But that accent remains. I guess maybe this is the time even to reveal that my name, when my parents arrived, our name when my parents arrived in New York from Russia, was not even Shore. It was a different name. My father gave his name on arrival. The officer said, "What's your name?" And my father gave it. The name was Chornomorets, which in Russian means Black Sea. And the immigration officer asked for it a couple of times, some of my mother told me, and unable to write it down, write down Shore, S-C-H-O-R-R, and said, "Mr. Shore, welcome to America."
How did your parents feel about the name change? Did your mother care?
Well, I don't think so. Understand the process of Americanization involved a great deal of casting off old things and acquiring America all of a sudden. And so while I don't think my parents would have voluntarily on their own changed their name, and if they hadn't, I could just see myself with how many sign-offs, "This is Daniel Chornomorets in Moscow," or whatever, I think they accepted it as a part of the price of admission into this wonderful country.
Did you feel, in a way, that you had to be a journalist for your mother? A lot of times when a kid is growing up who was born in America, sometimes that kid has to translate not only the language, but a lot of the culture for the parent.
Well, that's right. And journalism didn't transfer very well into their culture. When my mother asked me at about 13, 14 what I wanted to be, and I said a journalist, she looked at me very disapprovingly. "So you don't want something like lawyer or doctor with a degree?" Which is what Jewish kids did, you know, lawyer, doctor, those were the two things. And journalists didn't carry a degree. And in fact, I recall my mother saying to me, "Journalist, isn't that a little bit like show business?" at that time.
Little did she know.
Little did she know. But I said yes, and she came to it. She came to accept it. She came actually to be a little proud of it. She came to understand that journalism was A, respectable, and B, that you can make a living at it, more important.
You know, this innate feeling that it was your job to detach yourself from what was happening and describe it, did that apply to very emotional things that were happening to you, too? Did you find yourself trying to distance yourself from that and describe it as well?
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. It maybe gets us deeper into psyche than I really planned to go. But since you ask, I've wondered myself about it. I've wondered myself about this dispassionate, disinterested view that I have of world and dramatic events and sometimes tragic events. And wonder whether, unable to come to terms with the death of my father when I was very young, that I was able then to deal with my father's death by removing myself from it, and thus learned to remove myself from a great many painful things.
I think it was in 1953 that you were recruited by Edward R. Murrow for the CBS news team. I mean, this is the most celebrated news team in television history. What was it like for you? Did it feel worthy of the celebration?
Well, that was interesting, too. I had that. This is 1953, and I was working in Western Europe, living in Holland, working in Western Europe as a stringer for various New York Times, for Time magazine, and for CBS. And Murrow was impressed. He sent a cable, which read, "Would you at all consider, would you at all consider joining the staff of CBS with an initial assignment in Washington?" And I can remember the first time I appeared on that show. I had just come back from Moscow, and appeared on this ad lib show of an hour and a half. And when we just finished taping it, I was sitting there at the Circle. Murrow sort of walked over and looked at me. He's a very understated man. Walked over and looked at me and said, "Sure, you'll do."
Did that feel really good?
That felt very, very good.
Through all your career as a reporter, you tried to keep yourself out of the story. And as an analyst, I mean, your thoughts are the story. Your analysis is the story.
But not my emotions.
But not your emotions. Right, right.
And I think that to sort of anticipate your question, but if I haven't anticipated right, you'll tell me. I think that news analysis goes along with objective journalism. Mm-hmm. As long as you say the way you think things are instead of the way you want things to be. And I think that information has become simply altogether too complex for people to be able to understand without some help from people with backgrounds. So I don't regard news analysis on NPR or anywhere as being different from what I consider to be the objective journalism, which has been my idol.
So in other words, you're saying that you see analysis as being in part about synthesis so that to help people make sense of a lot of facts and put them in some kind of context?
That's right. In the CNN age, in the age of CNN, where things are brought to you live, you can see happening everything that's happening and have everything there except understanding what it means. And I think the more live news people get, the more they need help in understanding it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Daniel Shore is senior news analyst for National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Wherever I go, people tell me how much they learn from Daniel Shore's news analysis. So we thought you'd enjoy learning a little bit more about Dan Shore himself. I guess that's part of what we're about here at Fresh Air, making connections between a person's life and their work, work we know that you already value. Of course, Dan Shore is one of the people that makes public radio worthy of your time. Now I must be bold enough to say that we're also worthy of your financial support. Your station needs your support so it can continue to bring you programs like Fresh Air and All Things Considered. Thank you for your support. Here's how to make that pledge. Like many of us, music critic Milo Miles admits he doesn't know much about flamenco music, but he knows what he likes, and he likes the new flamenco anthology called Duende.
In theory, flamenco should be one of my favorite kinds of world pop music. It's compulsively eclectic, highly percussive, and over the top at its calmest. Yet flamenco singers have often sounded hokey to me, and flamenco's fusions with rock and other musics have seemed very shallow. And another problem is its formidable scope. To outsiders, flamenco appears to have as much history and as many heroic figures as, I don't know, cricket. And it's so hard to choose among the relatively few flamenco recordings available. Now producer and compiler Angel Romero has come to the rescue with Duende, a 3-CD collection that should make believers out of skeptics and the uninitiated. Flamenco has a rather odd history. It began in the south of Spain, often played by gypsies, but not created by them. Flamenco took off big in the middle of the 19th century, became a craze by the early 20th century, then went into a tailspin from the 20s through the 1950s. As fascism faded in Spain, flamenco came out of the shadows. By now, it's as popular as it has ever been, and probably more varied, with more virtuoso players. Angel Romero handles this sprawl by devoting the first disc to singers, the second to guitarists, and the third to a younger generation of progressives. I'm still convinced flamenco vocalists are a bit of a challenge, but you'd have to be a lump not to appreciate the powerful voice of the classic flamenco singer who called herself the girl with the combs. The highest compliment you can pay an anthology is that its selections flow together as an engaging work that stands on its own. And that is decidedly the case with the third CD of Duende, called Exploration. Among the several surveys of new flamenco that have come out in recent years, this is by far the smartest and most listenable. Rock, jazz, even Indian music are putty in flamenco hands. By the way, there's nothing by the Gypsy Kings, probably because they're well known already, but I'd like to think it's because they're so darned fatuous. Still, bands that have never done anything for me in the past, such as Katama and Patanega, sound hungry and vital in this context. Brash eclectics like the band Amalgama deliver penetrating, on-target songs that testify to flamenco's flexible spirit. I'm not even sure I would rush out and get more work by the artists represented here, but Angel Romero's presentation sure intrigues me. And Duende should help anyone get up to speed with flamenco.
Music critic Milo Miles, he reviewed the 3-CD set of flamenco music called Duende on the Ellipsis Arts label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave, research assistants from Becky Cohn. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Lauren Bacall reflects on acting, her marriage to Humphrey Bogart, and her life now as an older single woman. And Robbie Robertson looks back on his years with the band. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.